Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers, episode number 62, Deformed Special Relativity. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/62. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, related papers, and anything else I think of along the way. And now, Jim and Randy.
Hey Randy, how's it going?
Jim, it's always good to hear from you. I think we're going to have some fun talking about what theoretical physicists love to do in today's episode.
What do theoretical physicists love to do?
Break the laws of physics and see if they can put it back together in a way that still makes sense.
Well, what physics are we going to break? What's going on here? What are we talking about?
I think I'd only heard about this tangentially, maybe in passing here and there, but there's a concept out there that has been called doubly special relativity, which I think is the original form that I heard about it in. And I think it gained some level of notoriety a few years ago when it predicted that different frequencies of photons from gamma ray bursters would arrive at a different time than other frequencies of photons. And this was an interesting experimental opportunity for astrophysicists and physicists to get involved in. But it's also called deformed special relativity, which is probably a more accurate nomenclature. It's a weird one. It's a really weird one. Do you want to give a little bit of a background on what they're talking about here?
Well, I mean, what they're talking about in the papers that we're going to look at today is what happens if space-time has a minimal length scale. And they're trying to look at it in a specific way. So they're saying if you have loop quantum gravity, which we talked about previously, you do have sort of a minimum size of a little volume of space-time. And what they want to see here is what are the effects of that when you aren't dealing with, let's say, quantum electrodynamics, or you aren't dealing with quantum field theory, and you aren't dealing with general relativity. So what happens when you turn off both the quantum stuff and you turn off the gravitational stuff? When you turn both of those things off, what's left with space-time? What do you have to do to what we call Minkowski space, that flat four-dimensional space-time that still obeys the rules of special relativity? One of the first things you're going to do when you have a quantum gravity theory like loop quantum gravity, for loop quantum gravity, for string theory, for asymptotic safety, one of the things you want to do is you want to look at the limits, right? You want to see, if I turn off gravity, let's say, do I still get quantum field theory up? If I turn off quantum mechanics, do I still get gravitation out, general relativity? What the person that I know that did the most on this was Giovanni Amelino Camelia. I think he did this with Lee Smolin, but I'm not completely sure.
He's in one paper in your addendum, The Principle of Relative Locality. He did this with Lee Smolin.
Yeah, and he did a lot of work on this. So, so what he's talking about doing is, we want to look at this particular limit where we turn off both quantum mechanics and general relativity, but we want to do it in such a way that we're turning them off together coherently and see what happens after that. And the way to do that is to say, okay, we think what we have is a minimal length scale, or we think what we have is a maximum energy scale. Let's say. And that maximum energy scale is the Planck length, which depends on the speed of light, it depends on the gravitational constant, and it depends on the Planck constant. So he says, okay, we're going to take that Planck length, when we turn off both gravity and quantum mechanics, we're going to turn them off in a way so that their product, basically, I think, stays constant. And when you do that, you end up with this thing where you have a minimal length scale in a flat-ish space-time. And that screws a few things up because you can't really do that without letting the speed of light vary. And it varies according to the energy of the particle. And now this is going to cause all sorts of problems.
Yep. I think Sabine Hossenfelder talked about how this minimal length scale translates to a specific Planck mass, which I think is on the order, I think it's like 100 million kilograms. And so she was looking at a scenario where if you have a photon that has an energy equivalent to 100 million kilograms, then in this theory, that photon would be at rest, that the speed of light would slow down for particles as they approach this enormous mass, or photons that approach this enormous mass. And so all observers should agree that that photon is at rest, which is a really weird finding. And it kind of does end up breaking everything that we think about in physics and putting it all on its head. It's kind of a mind teaser, you know, trying to get your head around this one.
And that's where you get something like, you know, that principle of relative locality, right? So locality, and I think that's what the middle paper was, right? The classical paradoxes of locality and their possible quantum resolutions in deformed special relativity, by Lee Smolin. When he was looking at this, he was trying to look at this as an issue where what counts as local depends on the different individuals. Not so much their individuals, but the individual's state. So the observer who's moving at a speed relative to some other observer sees locality differently in some way, meaning that two things that coincide may not coincide for another observer, which is different from what we look at in special relativity and general relativity and quantum field theory. Everybody agrees that when two things collide in those theories, they collide for all observers, even though there are other different things that might change, right? Like when they collide, what it looks like when they collide, things like that. They still collide. That principle of locality is inbuilt in these other theories. So this principle of relative locality is sort of a generalization of that. And that is about 6 months after that classical paradoxes came out.
And his paper seemed to be a response, at least in some key areas, on the paper, The Box Problem in Deformed Special Relativity, by another one of our favorite physicists, Sabine Hassenfelder, which was published in 2009, where she looks at this.
Yeah, so Hassenfelder puts together a really clever paradox, right? How did you understand the paradox?
As I understand it, she took three different, basically, reference points. A high-energy photon coming from a gamma-ray burst, a low-energy photon, I think, coming from the same gamma-ray burst, and then a low-energy electron somewhere near the experimental apparatus. And she charts how their world lines converge on a single point with respect to an observer who's at rest with the laboratory frame. And then she looks at what this would look like to, I think, some observers in a satellite passing over the laboratory frame, and how the difference in the propagation speed of the very high energy photon would lead to a scenario where, in the first scenario in the lab frame, all three points converge. The photons interact with the electron, change its energy state, and then that electron can trigger a bomb, which blows up the lab. And then to the satellite observers, the three particles don't coincide within the lab frame, so the electron doesn't change its energy state in the lab frame, and so there's no explosion at all. So there's a paradox here. How can both observers be seeing the same thing if the lab blows up in one observer's reality, but not in another one?
And so that's putting it in that same light, right? So these two observers see a different version of the coincidences, right? In one frame, everything comes together at one point. In another frame, they don't. And so you don't end up with a result. In this case, to make it very dramatic, Sabine Hassenfelder said, let's make that a bomb, just for the inherent drama of the thing. So she's not the only one to make a similar claim. Apparently, Unruh found a similar situation. And those two things seem to be quite at odds with each other. Hassenfelder's work here said she got a distance of what? Was it?
Kilometers, I recall.
An entire kilometer. So that's going to make it hard to hide the issue, right? because we all get the same reality, even if we get different views of it. That's more or less what relativity is about. We might see things differently, but it's the same reality in the end.
Although it does make you wonder when you look at some of these, like the Wigner's friend paradox, you know, is it like in quantum field theory? It does seem to be possible that different observers are going to note a different reality. So there is some question there, like, does quantum field theory offer an explanation or a resolution? And so she looked at the uncertainty principle that might be magnified in this theory of deformed special relativity and create kind of like a wave packet distribution that would be large enough to encompass this difference in locality, right?
Was that Sabine or was that Lee?
I think Sabine Hossenfelder proposed this in her box problem paper, and then Lee Smolin built on that and commented on it also in his paper.
Yeah, I thought that was sort of the main thing with his paper, was trying to figure out a way to brush this under the carpet,
right,
with quantum mechanics.
She had proposed it, but then he developed it from a different direction, because he was looking at Kappa Poincaré non-commutative algebra.
I didn't read any of those references, so that's pretty heavy reading. Not like this, right? I'm sure you didn't have any problems with any of the weird things here. I thought it was interesting how Smolin started working with this, right? Because what he decided was to play around with space and time. And he said, okay, well, normally, you know, when we some sort of measurement in time and space, they commute, right? Time and space commute. We don't have to worry about that at all, right? And I think space and space commute. So we don't have to worry about those measurements. I'm going to cut that out because I don't think that's true. So what he wants to know is, okay, if space and time don't commute, how can we get them back to commuting so we can measure them at the same time? Because if we can do that, then we can actually talk about this paradox. Because if we're dealing with a quantum mechanical situation, and if the time and space measurements don't commute, then we have a minimum uncertainty, but we don't really know how to compare the measurements. We can't really compare measurements of events, where an event is in space-time, if time and space don't commute. So we decided to say, instead, what we're going to do is we're going to shove that uncertainty into the momentum space and modify time, so we basically take out the uncertainty in a way. And that causes all sorts of problems. Does interesting things that should happen. Of course, what do we notice right away when you do that? We've said that we're going to turn off quantum mechanics, and now we're trying to use quantum mechanics to sweep things under the rug. That's getting a little bit iffy, but it might not be that iffy, because in one sense we're going to quantum field theory, then back down, so maybe just regular old quantum mechanics will help us, but I'm not sure.
Because, I mean, the idea itself is founded in quantum mechanics using the Planck length and everything, so it makes sense that there would be a fundamental participation of quantum field theory in here, right?
Remember, the minimal length scale, you can get it a couple of ways. Some of them don't make much sense this way. So the entire way I ended up proposing this was first by picking up another thing by Sabine Hossenfelder, which was A Living Review of Relativity, Minimal Length Scale Scenarios for Quantum Gravity, which, you know, I was thinking we could read part of, because it's a huge review article. It's not that huge. It's only about 70 pages or so. But it's pretty dense. And this kept showing up in that. But at the very beginning, she has some very nice, sort of simplified ways to talk about minimal length scales. For something like these numbers we were talking about, we were just talking about the Planck length, right? Talk about the Planck mass, talk about the Planck time. These were all devised by Planck, not as minimal length scales or minimal time scales or maximum energy scales or anything like that. They were devised as ways to communicate with aliens.
Right. What?
What Planck was thinking was, if we're going to communicate with aliens with radio waves or something like that, and we want to say, well, how tall are we? Well, how are we going to do that?
So you have to use a wavelength and then multiply it by a multiplier, right?
Yeah, so you have to have some way of telling them how big something is, right? He was saying, well, we don't know what all of the different conditions are going to be in the world, but we do know that if they can receive these radio waves, you're a pretty advanced civilization, so you should have some knowledge of physics. So you should be able to figure out what something like the Planck constant is. that's still going to show up in your physics. The speed of light is still going to show up in your physics. And the gravitational constant is still going to show up in your physics. Now, all sorts of other things might happen. You might have weird mathematics invented in some other way. I don't know. But these things are fundamental constants, and they're going to know these things. So what we do is we say, okay, we've got these three constants with different units, right? The speed of light has a velocity unit. The Planck constant has the units of angular momentum. And the gravitational constant has really weird units, but you should be able to figure them out. So if you take each of these, we've got these three different constants with different units that can't be made up from one another. They're linearly independent in the jargon. You have these three things together, you can put them together and you can say, okay, I've got these three constants with three different units, I can make combinations of those. And so that's one way to get these things, right? If you say, you know, if you take this fundamental length scale from these three units, so we have 10 to the 35 of those things makes a meter, that gives you a pretty good range of how tall we are, right? How big things are on Earth.
So you got a universal ruler and a universal mass, a universal velocity. I see. So you're basically building a language so you can describe things in terms that are, you know, don't depend on totally arbitrary things like meters and...
Yeah, so we're not worried about human heartbeats. We're not worried about taking the circumference of the Earth and dividing by 400,000, which was the original definition of the meter. You know, stuff like that. We don't have to worry about all that crap. We're just saying, okay, these are things that everybody should agree upon, unless physics is even weirder than we thought. If physics is breaking those things down, it probably is going to break down the radio signals too, so we don't have to worry about it. That's one way to do it. The other way, another easy way is look at the convergence of the Schwarzschild radius for a black hole and the Compton wavelength, and where those two things meet, also ends up being about 10 to the minus 35 meters. That's the Planck length. There are actually a lot of coincidences. You know, if you say, okay, plus or minus in the order of magnitude or so, there are a lot of things that meet at that particular range. So it's fairly interesting. And in this minimal length scales, Zabina goes through a bunch of them. Hassenfelder goes through a bunch of them. I should be nicer, more formal.
Yeah, she's pretty intense. I don't want to get on her bad side. Like, she's got a kind of snarky sense of humor.
Okay, so she's perfect for your next interview. So I was looking at that, but I noticed was this AA special relativity, this deformed special relativity. After we got out of the first chapter or the second chapter, whatever it was, just kept showing up. And I said, well, if we're going to actually look at the minimum length scale thing, then we're going to have to look at the deformed special relativity. So then we come to, you know, finding out that there's a big problem with the DSR, also by this Zabina Hassenfelder. And I was surprised because the articles here are 3 years before this last update of the Living Review. So we come back and I'm finding out that there's a big problem now with all of this convergence problems. That's one of the problems. The other one, I think, is the gamma ray burst one that you alluded to earlier. But Smolin, I think, keeps this as this, not necessarily DSR. I don't think I've seen a reference to deformed special relativity by him for about 5 years or 6 years or something like that. But he does care about this relative locality. He's saying that one of the things that he wants in his research program is to keep this sort of relative locality in place. What else did you see in the deformed special relativity now that I've been talking for 10 minutes nonstop?
So they're talking about an energy-dependent but observer-independent speed of light. That's the problem. That it seems like any way that you look at this, it destroys our idea of locality. And so you end up with these paradoxes where different observers are witnessing different realities. And Sabine-Hassenfelder brought forward that idea of using the uncertainty principle over the travel time to kind of smear out the wave packet of a photon so that there's an overlap. So you can't discern that these particles aren't intersecting at the same point anymore because there's this big uncertainty. But I think that would change the probability of interactions because that would get smeared out too. So photons that would be coming from a great distance, like a distant gamma ray burster, would have different reactions, different probability distributions of interactions with experiments inside a lab frame. with respect to other photons that occurred that were emitted very close to the apparatus. So it seems like no matter how you try to solve the problem, you still end up with the problem that you have to sacrifice not only the constancy of the speed of light, but also the observer independence, which was one of the founding reasons why the principles they were looking at here was trying to find a model where there was an energy dependence, but an observer independence. So it seems like it's irreconcilable to me. I mean, maybe that's reconcilable by doing what I think you were talking about Smolin was looking at, was taking the commutativity into like phase space or momentum spaces so that they became the more fundamental factors that would replicate a reality that seemed to disagree to our physical senses. But again, that doesn't really seem to solve the problem from like an experimental observation standpoint. And I think that's what Sabine Hossenfelder was saying in this third paper that we looked at, where she seemed to be responding pointedly. And this was comments on the non-locality and deformed special relativity that she wrote right after Smolin's classical paradoxes of a locality paper. And she seemed to make the arguments in a much more forceful and concise manner and basically reduce this form of special relativity pretty much to ashes, as far as I can tell. I mean, was that your take on it?
Yeah, I think she did a pretty good number on them. Yeah, I think basically the paradoxes that she and Unruh put together are damning for this particular idea about what this relative locality is. So this is just one idea, one way to get it. Although people still refer to it, it's not a huge program. It doesn't have a lot of people running through it. But I'm not sure how many you'd expect to have running through this particular thing unless there was a particular success. And I think, and it seems to me they had a, I'm not sure if it's a complete failure, but I mean, with the gamma ray bursts not showing up so much, it seems to me like they don't have anything going for it. I mean, there are a couple other papers that I wanted to read that I didn't, that may have changed my mind a little bit. Right now, it seems to me that it didn't really work out, and you have to approach, if you want to do something like this, then you have to approach it differently. You can't say the Planck length is constant when you take h bar and g going to zero, and just hope that it comes out of loop quantum gravity or string theory or something like that. But that particular way isn't going to work.
It was a neat idea, though, because, you know, this is just one of the different ways that, you know, that we see in theoretical physics all the time, that advances are made, where you look at laws of physics as you know them as a special case, and then you look at the broader picture, and in this case, much higher energies that invoke, you know, Planck-length scales to see if you can, if all of what you know about physical reality can be just be the special case from a much broader and much more complex model. So it was really, I think, a theoretically well-motivated approach, you know, because we've seen this successful in the past, I mean, with Newtonian physics and relativity.
Well, yeah, I think it is possible that part of the problem is that we don't have a good theory of quantum gravity. And the approaches people are using right now, although they each solve some problems, they all have their own problems. Something like this could be possible, I'll say that, for the complete theory. It's just not working out with the theories that we have. And that might be indicative of several things. One, it could be just something minor in one of these theories that isn't letting it work. It could be that, you know, it's just got to be a completely different theory, and nobody's figured out what that theory might be that is compatible with quantum field theory, that is compatible with general relativity, and gives you some sort of quantum gravity. And, of course, it could be that this particular limit doesn't actually make sense, right? That if you're going to go down to a flat space-time, you're getting rid of the things that require the granularity, require this Planck length, for example, this minimal length scale, and you don't get a minimal length scale when you're not in a situation where you have a large gravitational field. You just don't have to worry about it at all. The whole point of deformed special relativity is not just to confirm that you get special relativity. It's to try to find something that's slightly different than special relativity when you take that one order out. So zeroth order in this Planck mass might be a special relativity, but the first order has some small deformation, right, which would be equivalent to the perihelion of Mercury was for general relativity, which would be something like the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron in quantum electrodynamics. So what you're really looking for is something like that, some sort of small deviation from the limit that has some experimental consequences that actually turn out to be true.
Yeah, it points to a broader theory of physics in general. So if I understand this properly, maybe you can set me straight here, but it seems like the whole motivation for looking down these kind of pathways is the system of natural units, where if you set, you know, the gravitational constant and H-bar and C to 1, then the significance of the units that fall out of that, like the Planck mass, the Planck length, suddenly begins to look really intriguing. Is that the idea?
I don't think that's the main use of this. I think there is some belief that each one of these different units, the Planck mass, the Planck time, the Planck length, they all have some real meaning. Now, I'm not sure if they all have some real meaning, right? I've never really been convinced that the Planck mass has a real meaning. I'm willing to believe, for the reasons we just talked about, that there are many different ways that you end up with a Planck length, that there is something interesting about that Planck length. And there seems to be something interesting about that Planck length in quantum gravity, for example. In quantum gravity, there seems to be something interesting about that length. So if you're saying that one of the things that's going to happen with quantum gravity is that you're going to quantize space in some way, then it makes sense that quantization has something to do with this Planck length, this combination of H-bar and G and the speed of light.
I seem to remember years ago reading about an astrophysics experiment where they were looking at, I guess, light dispersion across, you know, huge billions of light years of distance. And they were saying that if there was a granularity to space-time, if there was like a minimum volume, that it would have had a certain effect on photons propagating over huge distances like that, that they should have been able to detect, and they didn't. So either there isn't a granularity to space-time, or the laws of physics are kind of orchestrated in a way that it would disguise this kind of dispersion that would happen from a granularity to space-time. So I'm suspicious of this idea that there's like a minimum length.
Okay, well, I mean, that's completely reasonable. I don't think anybody's shown that there's a minimum length. They have all of these coincidences. But I think, at least in like loop quantum gravity, there must be that sort of minimum length. There's something similar that shows up in string theory, right, which is sort of the minimum size of a string. So it seems like something like a minimal length scale shows up naturally in a lot of these theories.
Clear whether they have any actual physical meaning, you know.
Yeah, what does the minimal length scale actually mean, right? If you're looking at something like de Hooft's sort of cellular automata theory of, you know, space-time, then all of a sudden it does have a real physical meaning because you have to worry about the size of the cells. But it's not really a size of the cell. It's because, you know, you're dealing with a spin foam. What does that mean? How does this really relate to the size of a string? Strings have this minimum size, but what about the space between the strings? Stuff like that. My impression is that string theory really just takes, you know, a flat space-time background as parameters, sort of like quantum field theory, and uses that. So I don't think it has the same requirements like loop quantum gravity does for integrating space-time with the gravitational interaction.
I think I've also come across the idea in some articles years ago that I read that where the Planck length would be a scale at which if we take the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to its extreme and we say that there's a zero-point energy in space-time, then at the Planck length scale, the energy of the zero-point energy would be so high that gravitational effects would become enormous, and measuring spaces becomes a really tricky, if not insoluble, problem. Because you're so far from the Minkowski background at that point.
I mean, if you're looking at actually measuring the size of something like that, I mean, you're dealing with a lot of energy. So yeah, you can say it's tricky, but is it impossible? You have to be able to interpret whatever you're doing in some way. And if we want to go another 10 to 15 orders of magnitude down from what we can measure right now, that maximum radius of an electron, it's like 10 to the minus 22 or something like that. We need another 10 to 15 orders of magnitude smaller. That might need a whole other theory to actually interpret the results. Loop quantum gravity, for example, is a theory that you might be able to use to interpret those results. If you had an experiment that could get you that kind of energy so that you could actually probe it. Now, possibly, there'll be things that show up earlier than that, right? And I think people are looking for statistical ways to talk about that. Possibly that's what the people who were talking about the observations you were talking about earlier. I'm not sure what class of theories they're actually going to disprove, because I haven't read the paper. But it's going to be something like, you know, the Bell inequalities, right? The Bell inequalities don't disprove every hidden variable theory. You have to look at exactly which hidden variables are done for each particular theory. And then people say, okay, well, there are all these other kinds of hidden variables that might be out there that aren't quite classical. So now you have to modify your experiments and do more experiments and so forth and so on. And people love that because it keeps them occupied and employed and stuff like that. But maybe one kind of minimal length scale is out of that because of those experiments. I haven't read them, so I'm not sure.
Well, maybe we should take a look at some of these. You know, I'd like to read more about asymptotic safety and cellular automata. That sounds like good stuff. When you were talking about the minimum size of the electron, is like, I think, 10 to the minus 22 meters, I assume. Are you talking about the experiments they've done where they've been trying to detect any structure with the sphericity, the sphericality, I guess you'd call it, of the electron? Where they probe it with higher and higher energies to see if they can see any kind of geometry, and they still can't see any beyond a point-like distribution, even down to like 10 to the minus 22 meter.
Yeah, so that sort of says, well, this is the maximum size of an electron. If it were larger, then we probably would see it. So that's not the size of the electron, that's the maximum size of the electron. Then, as far as we know, the electron could still be infinitely small, right? Because one of the options here is that, you know, space-time is not discrete in any way. That would make all the quantum gravity guys sad, but it's still an option. Personally, I don't really think that's true, but it possibly could be. I like a lot of these ideas that come along with it. Like, rather than having really points in space-time, we just have relationships between objects and stuff like that. I like that idea, but I don't really know what to make of it, and I don't really know what that means in the end. So I think that's what we've got for deformed special relativity. I don't know. Do you have any other things to talk about? I was a little bit disappointed after I actually started reading the papers, to be honest, because it looks like it doesn't mean as much as I thought it was going to mean based on reading the review article. There are some other things in the review article as well that are important, like generalized uncertainty principles that are sort of related to the minimal length question. But we don't have a real knowledge of how big the minimal length scale is. We've got some coincidences that make a lot of sense. Yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine how we're going to resolve the early instant of the Big Bang, the creation of the universe, until we understand if there's, you know, what there's significance of minimum length scales is. You know, like, how are we going to understand conditions where the entire universe was, they say the entire mass of the universe was squeezed down to the size of a baseball? If we don't have a clear understanding of minimum length scales and how they play a role in like charge distribution and fundamental interactions, I'm not sure how we're going to get any further to understanding the whole origin of the universe.
Yeah, if this stuff is real, then it's going to have some effects on the origin of the universe, but the origin of the universe is getting more mysterious all the time. Yeah, that's just me. That's not the real people talking, but there are some things that I'm less convinced of every time I look into it. And the origin of the universe is one of those things.
One of the things that confounds me about that question is they say that space-time and matter were born simultaneously in the Big Bang. So, apparently, space-time itself expanded during the inflationary epoch at some ridiculous rate. So, how do you measure distances when you're dealing with extremely intense gravitational fields in the early moments of the Big Bang when the universe was as dense, you know, so dense that it fit in it was like the size of a baseball? From what point of reference are you scaling that? You know, if you were within that sphere, would your sense of distance be... It's kind of like a black hole. I mean, your sense of distance would be different than an external observer, but there are no external observers. So how can you measure a length in a situation where you've got a gravitational gradient that's that extreme? Would one of your ruler also get compressed enormously.
Yeah, I mean, your ruler is going to change similarly. But, I mean, it's the same way that you talk about, you know, the whole universe is expanding at the same time, right? And it's probably something like, you know, the proper time or the or something like that, right? You'd use ideas like that to tell you for a particular object, for a particular path, what is the distance between here and here? What is the time between here and here? Given you do this and given you do that. I mean, just find consistent ways to do it. It's not impossible to do that in general relativity already. So now if you have something more like a spin foam or something like that, then it gets more difficult. I think that if you're really dealing with quantum gravity, then you don't have really length yet. That's one of the things that a lot of, at least in loop quantum gravity, they're going to say is that if you're dealing with things that are really compact, if you're dealing with things with this really large gravity and things that are really close together, you know, you might not have enough space in between to have something like a length. I mean, I guess that's a bad way to say it, but you might not have enough different little tiny bits of space-time objects to have some sort of statistical measure like a length. So a length becomes a statistical measure in some way, and if things aren't far enough apart in some way, whatever that distance means, right, because it's no longer in meters, it's in terms of interactions, it's in terms of this sort of random number of cells in between things that might be changing and fluctuating, right? In that case, if you can't have that statistical measure, then it doesn't mean anything, some of the things that we might want to talk about.
There are models of quantum gravity, though, that don't require a minimum length scale, aren't there? Isn't, like, the entropic gravity one of those?
Is entropic gravity a quantum gravity?
I thought it was, because I always assumed that since it was entropy, then that kind of quantum field theory.
The entropy is statistical in nature, but that doesn't necessarily make it quantum. Now, some things have to do with quantum mechanics, but just having statistical things that are quantum mechanical doesn't make it quantum gravity. Quantum gravities, I think, usually are things that integrate general relativity with quantum mechanics. They're not just doing quantum mechanics on a curved background. We have to actually integrate the two things together, right? Both the quantum mechanics and the gravity. When you're talking about entropic gravity, the class that they call that, it's emergent gravity. The quantum mechanics is fundamental, but the gravity actually isn't fundamental, which is sort of what we think right now. Gravity is something that comes from the statistics of all the other things in space-time. So that's a long way to get around to what I was trying to say.
Well, all right. Thanks for going over this with me, Jim. I think we pretty much covered this one. There's a lot of details we could get into, but I'll let you go. Thanks for your time, my friend.
Nice talking to you, Randy. Bye now.
Be well, my friend. Bye-bye.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers, episode number 62, Deformed Special Relativity. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/62. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, some of the other papers that we mentioned, and anything else I might think of along the way. I'm afraid I do have some sad news. While I was editing this podcast, Randy passed away. So Randy passed away about a month ago at this point, and Randy is my friend of a decade. The major reason for this podcast was really so that we would keep in touch, at least from our end, you know, talk about things that we enjoyed talking about previously. So I'd like to ask that, if you have not already, take a moment to remember him, and thank you for listening. Bye now.